doing whatever I had to do to survive. I'm not saying what I did was all right. Trying to break out of the ghetto was a day-to-day fight. Being down so long, getting up didn't cross my mind. But I knew there was a better way of life, and I was just trying to find. You don't know what you do till you put under pressure. Across 110th Street is a hell of a tester. Across 110th Street, pimps trying to catch a woman that's weak. Across 110th Street, pushers won't let the junkie go free. Across 110th Street, woman trying to catch a trick on the street. You bet it.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
Here at KBOO, we honor the indigenous people whose traditional and ancestral homelands we stand on. The Multnomah, Kathlamet, Clackamas, Tomwater, Wetlala Bands of the Chinook, the Tualatin Kalapuya, and many other indigenous tribes and nations of the region of the Willamette River and that great river known as Shuaneku, Wimal, Nishaiwana, and Columbia. Many names for the living water force that has sustained this region for countless generations and provided phenomenal life to our blessed ecosystems. We believe it is important to acknowledge the ancestors of this land and to recognize that we are here because of the sacrifices forced upon them. In remembering these communities, we honor their legacy, their lives, and their descendants with the forming of relationships to each other and the living world.
Welcome to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program that showcases radio production by independent community media. We bring local stories to a global audience produced at a different location every week. Today on Sprouts, we feature an interview about promoting traditional food systems and farming techniques. This show is produced by Heartland Stories Radio, a weekly program about the future of food, farming, and public health. Listen now as host Teresa Marquez introduces Elena Terry.
I am Teresa Marquez, and I'm here today with Elena Terry. Elena is the executive chef and founder of Wildberries, an educational community outreach nonprofit in Wisconsin that strives to bring ancestral foods to communities in a nurturing and nourishing way. She's also the food and culinary program coordinator for the Native American Sovereignty Alliance. Welcome, Elena.
Hello.
What I failed to say just now was you're also part of the Ho-Chunk Nation of Wisconsin. So that's pretty exciting for me because I live near Ho-Chunk Nation land, and it's just been really a privilege. I'm wondering, Elena, you're a founder of something called Wildberries, and I just wondered if you could say something about it. And also, is it spelled B-E-A-R-I-E-S?
It is spelled Wildberries. And I do have one quick correction. I did help develop the culinary mentorship program for the Native American Food Sovereignty Alliance, but I am now just a contributing mentor. So I stepped aside from that position so that I could dedicate my attention to Wildberries.
Oh, okay. But tell us about Wildberries first. And it's about, berries, or is it about bears?
It's about community. And What we are is a community outreach nonprofit. We do provide services for people who are overcoming alcohol and other drug abuse issues or emotional traumas, primarily in the Ho-Chunk community, but we're not exclusive to Ho-Chunk community members. So we do service people that are tribal and non-tribal throughout the Americas, really. And it is all about connecting through food and the beauty of our ancestral foods, and what an incredible place to do it than our homelands here in Wisconsin.
You know, I am so pleased that, you know, it's both tribal and non-tribal, because we need so badly places like Wild Berries to do this very difficult work that you're doing. So maybe you could talk a little bit about Wild Berries. Like, how do you do outreach? Even though you're in the Dells area, are there other places that you have centers?
So we started with doing small caterings for our own tribe. And it was a group of people that really just enjoyed getting in the kitchen and cooking together and found a lot of peace and comfort in creating meals. And the connection that we had with each other kind of expanded into agriculture and really wanting to reconnect with our traditional foods and then our traditional food systems, and really how that started building our own little community. We wanted to expand that into broader communities. And it wasn't until I went to an intertribal food summit in Meskwaki, which is Tama, Iowa, at the Meskwaki Indian settlement, that I saw there was a greater community all working to reclaim this knowledge, these traditional food ways. The traditional food systems that we have and these food ways don't only affect our physical health and well-being, it also greatly affects our mental health and well-being. And the main purpose of Wild Berries on conception was to use food as a vessel to bring people back to our community. Because at some point, I think all of us, it's part of life, suffer a disconnect. You know, either it's you made a bad decision or there was lessons that you had to learn, but it's always having to overcome that obstacle to come back to your community. And so for some of us, that it's a little bit more difficult than for others. And we wanted to use food, and more specifically our ancestral and cultural and traditional food, to bridge that gap and use it as a vessel to invite people back literally to the table to share a meal, to replenish. You know, there's a reason that those disconnects happen. And I don't want to say that everything is linked to trauma, but there's a reason that we eat unhealthy. And it might be food security issues. It might be something that we have access to unhealthy foods or financial means. It's not always a choice. And so how do we break down some of those barriers? And some of it is, you know, the intimidation factor in saying that we welcome you to our table.
You had grandmothers and a great-grandmother that actually taught you a whole lot about food. Did I read that about you?
I'm blessed in that my ancestors knew the importance of sharing that knowledge, and not only sharing it, but also sharing it in a way that I understood it was my responsibility to continue that knowledge sharing in a way where my children and grandchildren will remember it and retain it and want to continue sharing it and understand that responsibility. And only because we have kept that tradition alive have we been able to have these food sources for, you know, 1,000+ years, our stories go back to creation, and these seeds being a part of our lives, or these animals and our relationship with them in our food systems, and how we really honor each other in life by, you know, respecting the food systems and the stewardship of the land, and really our responsibility to each other as just living beings. I guess if you think of them as plants or animals or anything, it's about fulfilling your destiny as a living being on this earth. And how can we do that I guess, in a more peaceful and positive way. You know, we did a lot of damage after World War II and the Industrial Revolution and all of these things that caused, you know, a great deal of scarring to the earth. And these incredible micro farms and, you know, organic movements and a reclamation of traditional practices when it comes to agriculture in general has been a breath of fresh air that we need, and really recognizing that everybody has a part to play in our food systems. Even if that's just that you are a consumer, everybody has a part to play, and being able to, I guess, hold your space in that part and know that your voice can make a difference, we can really change the way that we look at food for the next generation and hopefully prevent some of those physical and mental effects of poor diets.
You know, I'm really curious about something I read about you and some of the things that you're doing, that Wildberries is working with the Indigenous Seed Savers Network. And I wondered if you'd tell us about them.
Sure. Well, Wildberries has, since we are a nonprofit, our vice president and one of our board members, obviously, is a seed keeper. And we wanted to really take a holistic approach to our food systems and not just say, you know, I am a chef and I'm kind of blessed and definitely appreciate that that's my role, because I get all of it and I get to taste it and touch it and serve it and prepare it and hopefully honor all of the work being done to get those individual products to my hands. And one of those is growing our own food, because in order to keep it authentic and really honor those foods, we have to grow them ourselves. And so our vice president, who is Jessica Greendeer, she is also the farm manager at Dream of Wild Health, a nonprofit in Minnesota, and has her own micro farm here in the state of Wisconsin. She does our seed keeping and does our seed multiplication and management for us. And so when we get some of these incredible seeds back to us, they get to her hands, and then she kind of handles it until they're at a point where we can start growing them in our communities. And that is just because there is such a limited amount of them that we need to make sure that we have enough in case there is some agricultural devastation, which isn't an if, it's a when, and how significant that will affect us.
Very good point. And this, I just learned all about the Dream of Wild Health, which I love the name. Mm-hmm. And that the woman, Diane Wilson, I think founded it. And apparently she's started saving seeds starting like 30 years ago.
Yeah, Diane did publish a book. I'm not too sure if she is the one who founded it. I know she was a director there for a while, but it is just, there's so many contributing people to the work that's being done, and it needs to be done. I think the slow foods is a understatement to the work that we have to do to even just get, for example, we had a seed that was rematriated to us, which means it was brought back to our tribe, and it hadn't been grown in our tribe since the early to mid 1900s. And it's been this incredible story on the journey of this one little bean. And it came back to our tribe. And the work that we have to do when it comes to multiplying seeds and keeping their authentic DNA, you know, because they are living beings. So what we started out with is 10 bean seeds will turn out to, after the first grow, I think we got 50 viable bean seeds, and hopefully in 10 years we'll have enough to distribute some of those beans to our community to grow them. So it isn't really about me being able to reap the benefits of these beans coming home. It's about the intentions of my grandchildren being able to have these beans to feed their families, and knowing that my great-grandparents had these beans to help them get through times of, you know, great struggle.
Well, I am so excited about the fact that these beans are coming back. And when I think about indigenous cuisine, you know, I want these beans. Somebody serve them to me, please. And I was actually pretty impressed with your description of learning to cook from your great-grandma and your grandma. You did a lot of cooking with fire. And I wonder if there were other things that we really should learn from our indigenous friends and neighbors that you have come across.
Sure. I mean, we were able to live for thousands of years. You know, it with the land and as stewards of the land and being able to honor what it asked of us and what it needed for us to take care of, I think a lot of these traditional practices should be utilized. And, you know, the reason that we learned to cook on the, why I learned to cook on the open fire was that's the way they preferred to cook. And it didn't only add a different level of flavor to the food, but it was a space that we occupied together. You know, there were great conversations around that fireplace. And that was where my great-grandma chose to be. She had an incredible stove inside, but she wanted to be outside. She wanted that fire and all of the things that we did while we were outside around that fire were the lessons that were taught, not just cooking, you know, and all of those sensical memories that are instilled upon you in learning that way. You know, you can try and replicate the flavor, you can replicate the process, but it's the feelings and the teachings that you get from being in spaces like that that are instilled into your being, you know, that you can recall, that I even now as a, you know, a midlife adult, I can recall like yesterday and know that I feel comfort from that space.
What a lovely thought and memory. But, you know, you have so many talents besides being a chef and so knowledgeable about so many things about growing food and indigenous traditions. You also are a butcher and a wild game specialist. Could you say a little bit about that?
Yes, that came from them, from my grandmother and my great-grandmother, and just them wanting to make sure that I had that knowledge and me really appreciating being in that space with them, because I know that there are some of my cousins that didn't necessarily appreciate always, you know, doing that process. But for me, I think that just made it that much more rewarding because I had this unique kind of one-on-one time with them. And the more I spent with them and the more that they taught me about it in appreciating really honoring those animals. I've had discussions, as I'm sure you can imagine, with people who are vegetarians. And for me, I am not a hunter at all. I am the person that waits to process everything because that's where I feel I contribute. You know, I am a processor. And it's okay not to, you know, say that the hunting isn't a necessary part, because without them, I wouldn't have a job. You know? But it's really saying that we do understand how we treat each other. And the way my great-grandma and my grandmother explained it to me was, you think of that animal living its best life and being as fit as it can be and knowing that this one day it's going to give its life to feed your family and that it will forever be honored by your family because of that. You know, like you will always carry the spirit of that animal and knowing that it's going to help you get through, or, you know, and honoring it, and you never take more than you need and you share with as many as you can. And there's nothing wasted or discarded from that. You know, it's a very spiritual process. And I think of it that way. It's not a mass production plant. It's a very unique experience filled with prayer and appreciation. And I think if more people understood it that way, our whole food system would be looked at quite differently, you know, and appreciated not only the sacrifice, but that, you know, we all do have a destiny, and whatever that is, if it's, you know, a plant that's growing to its full potential to feed your family, or if it's growing to be therefore a pollinator or to feed that deer so that it has the strength to live, you know, another year, or however it is, we all have stories that connect us. And it isn't nothing is taken for granted. And I appreciate those lessons and those conversations that came with those experiences that my grandmothers gave me. It wasn't just, this is how you do it. It's, this is how you do it, and this is why we do it, and this is how we appreciate it, and this is how we pray for it, and this is how it is part of our life, not just this moment.
You're listening to Sprouts Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program bringing you local radio productions of global interest. Today, you're listening to an interview produced by Heartland Stories Radio, a weekly radio show featuring food, farming, and public health. We return now to our interview with Elena Terry.
If you're just joining us, I'm Teresa Marquez, and I'm here today with Elena Terry. Elena is the executive chef and founder of Wildberries, an educational community outreach nonprofit in Wisconsin that serves a large community of folks in need. You know, Elena, I really was caught, you know, with thinking about something that you said about decolonized food and colonized food. And I wondered if you could just help me out. And can you describe what you mean by decolonized food?
Sure. It's kind of a term that gets used quite a bit, but it really is recognizing that there was a time before Europeans came, or the colonists. And how did our food look prior to that, prior to processed wheat and white sugar and all of these things that have affected our body's ability to process food in has kind of shown up in forms of diabetes, high blood pressure, you know, even mental fatigues, and has started to affect us now in, you know, several generations down the line in having more accessibility to these foods where we're not able to process what little nutrients, if any, are in them, and how we are you know, paying this severe price for it with our health. And so decolonize is trying to take that out of our diets and honoring our traditional food systems. So the wild foods, the cultivated foods that are ancestral, so non-Monsanto or non-chemical, chemically grown as much as possible. I mean, I almost feel like the word organic, as much as it's honored, is also like a kind of a colonized term, because we were organic practice. You know, we didn't have to worry about those things before. So it's even trying to reclaim those traditional food sources in the way as traditional as we can in today's society, and really bringing those back into our communities in a way that's accessible.
You know, I had a very interesting, you're reminding me, interview with a woman by the name of Sarah Nelson. And she said that in the 60s and 70s, because of the instant food that was developed for the war, the corporations wanted to stop people from cooking from scratch at home. And so over 50% of the women now don't cook from scratch. I'm wondering whether, you know, part of what you're trying to do is help people start to learn to remember how to cook from scratch again.
Yeah, basically it is. It wasn't just even from the war and corporations. It was, if you think of centuries back, and how do we learn to manipulate a whole culture or a whole population? It's by affecting their food systems. If it's by removing the primary proteins, like eliminating all of the bison on the prairies, or by poisoning water and primary food supplies, or by burning down crops, which all have been not just attacks on indigenous people, you know, which have been attacks on people in their food sources. And then you think of classism and, you know, money. And if you're able to, when we came out of that unique time, what you're saying, the 60s and 70s, so much changed, and saying you have to go to the woods to get your food or you aren't able to go to the grocery store, that's almost the sentiment that was across the board. You know, like you were less than or considered less than if you grew your own food or if you went to forage for your food, not thinking that that was the most flavorful, authentic food possible. It was, you can't afford or you're not able to provide these incredible TV dinners for your family, you know? And that thought process really swept across the country and it stayed there when it comes to fast food and convenience and this is the best thing, even if it's, you know, diet meals that are frozen or however, rather than taking the time to do it. And it is a little intimidating. I know this, you know, cooking your own food, but it isn't impossible. You know, that's what we did. That's what we should be doing. And I'm speaking from a person that has to drive through drive-throughs on occasion, and I understand today's world, but every small step that you make to reclaim that space on how you feed yourself or your family is a change, and it's positive. You know, every time you make an attempt to do that, it is moving in the right direction and really reclaiming that power that you have to nourish your family.
You know, I'm very interested, see that you have talked about and know something about native archaeological spots where, you know, they've found gardens. I wondered if you'd tell us more about that.
Sure. I mean, right down the road from my house and is an archaeological site where they have confirmed over 1,000 years ago the Ho-Chunk people had raised garden beds. And it just is an incredible spot to testify that we were not only hunters and gatherers, but we were cultivators. And the seeds that exist today do so because of the intentions of our ancestors, and they knew the importance of cultivating that. And not only were those ancestral spots, you know, a historical record that we were cultivators, but we were also traders. And these great networks and communities that shared with each other to make sure that they didn't only have a diverse, you know, food system, but that they were able to help support each other when traveling or however they needed to provide for each other, that they were able to do that. We wouldn't have corn here if those trade routes didn't exist. And so it's just incredible to be able to see that. One of the first things that I do when I go to visit other tribes is to find out what their traditional food sources were, where they came from, and to learn about that, because we are such a diverse nation. And when you think of Turtle Island, you know, the way we like to consider the Americas, we don't see those borders. We just see different regions and different dialects and different, you know, such a beautiful, diverse population that there's so much incredible knowledge out there. How do we honor that, you know, with each other? And so, yeah, that's one of the things that I absolutely love to do is really find out the history of the space and know that, you know, our ancestors really did know so much about our food and our food systems, and there's so much knowledge that we need to reclaim for the future.
Well, this brings me to a really an important question for me anyway. And there's so many things that we can learn that we haven't learned very well from our indigenous population, those people who were here first, those people who took care of the land for 4,000 years. What would be the biggest lessons that you wish that the American public could take from the indigenous people?
You know, really, I do say this a lot because I think during the pandemic, it opened our eyes a lot that it's hard to have a healthy community if you're hungry. And our food insecurity issues were really brought to the forefront, you know, and this a necessary issue we need to address as a community or as a population. And how can we help each other be able to at least get to a point where you're not hungry every day, and then we can start moving towards, you know, a reclamation or, you know, a unification of cross-cultural appreciation. Because although I can speak from an indigenous background, every culture has this connection to their food and to their ancestors and to strength and resilience and overcoming obstacles that they've had to overcome. We all have the ability to heal, and food is medicine is this trendy phrase. Mm-hmm. But for me, and it's held through for my entire life, the medicine is in the creation, in the relationships that I build around food. It isn't one single bite that's the medicine for me. Mm-hmm. And so it's really hard to kind of wrap that up. But I think that all of us have the ability to create that food as medicine for ourselves on whatever level we need to do that. And by acknowledging that it has space in our culture and a connection to our traditions and our history, and as well as a connection to our future, I think we can all kind of find that in ourselves.
Thank you so much for doing all the great work that you're doing. I'm so excited for it, and I'm so happy that you are impacting and influencing a lot of different people.
Thank you, and I always appreciate the space.
That's it for Sprouts. You have been listening to an interview with Elena Terry. Sprouts theme music is Torpedoes on Tuesday by Poison Control Center. Sprouts is a weekly program produced in collaboration with community radio stations and independent producers across the globe. The program is coordinated and distributed by Pacifica Radio. If you or someone at your station has a radio production that you wish to showcase globally on Sprouts, contact our air traffic controller, Ursula Rudenberg, at ursula@pacifica.org. This week's producer was yours truly, Charlie Knorr. Thank you for listening, and see you next week on Sprout.
Greetings, I'm Ansa Krigland.
And I'm Winston Watson.
And I'm Donnie Clark.
And we are the Meditation.
We are listening to Community Radio.
KBOO
90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon.
Yeah. Dig it.
Welcome to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program that showcases radio production by independent community media. We bring local stories to a national audience, produced at a different location every week. Today on Sprouts, we feature an interview with Dr. Christopher Carter. This show is produced by Heartland Stories Radio, a weekly show featuring radio productions about the future of food, farming, and public health. Listen now as host Teresa Marquez introduces Professor Christopher Carter.
I am here today with the Reverend Dr. Christopher Carter. Dr. Carter is an assistant professor of theology and religious studies at the University of San Diego and a pastor in the United Methodist Church. And he just published his first book titled The Spirit of Soul Food, Race, Faith, and Food Justice. And he is on the board of directors of Farm Forward, which is an anti-factory farming nonprofit. I think I want to say Dr. Carter's life and his book makes it very clear that food must be part of the conversation when looking at race and racism. Welcome, Dr. Carter.
Thanks for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Dr. Carter, I really enjoyed the Spirit of Soul Food, and I see that, you know, you have really a deep, deep connection with the idea of food and agriculture and of your roots. And how is it that you, though, decided to become a pastor and also someone who is so active like this in the food and ag space? Where do you think you got this from?
Yeah, so for me, a lot of this, my motivation to do this work comes from my grandfather, Robert Merton. You know, Robert, born in Brookhaven, Mississippi in the early 40s. You know, so he was a migrant picker. And essentially what that means is, you know, he's in the fields as a child, working alongside his mother and brother and sister at this time, you know, picking cotton, you know, mostly cotton, I would say the vast majority of time of cotton, and sometimes picking corn or other types of, you know, just actual working on a farm, doing handiwork. But because of this, you know, he really only went to school till about fourth grade. He never really did school year round because he had to earn money to help essentially support the family. And so, you know, his experience growing up in the Jim Crow South, I think really informed me and made me pay attention to the ways in which way farm workers and factory farm workers are in systems of exploitation, right? I don't think I would have had that foreknowledge had he not talked about those experiences growing up. And so that it already had me thinking about these food systems in a particular kind of way. So when I was exposed to it as an adult, I had something to immediately connect it to, and I can make it personal, which is a big part of what motivated me to do this research in the first place.
I would love to talk with you about this colonization, for starters, if we can. And, you know, the decolonization that you're trying to do, I wondered if you could give us some insights into, when you talk about decolonization, what are some of the things that you are talking about? What is at the heart of decolonization for the African American, so particularly?
Yeah, no, thank you for your question. That's an excellent question. I think essentially decolonizing is trying to understand why we believe what we believe, right, to be true, right? So it's saying, it's just asking, literally simply asking the questions, why, where do we get these ideas and assumptions, and where did this become normal? And is this idea, assumption, or truth, is it consistent with our values? Is it consistent with who we see ourselves being? Or is it something that was ushered in as a part of what we might call the colonial project, which really is about the, you know, the conquest of the Americas? So you're talking about somewhere, you know, roughly around the 1500s, when we might say is the era of coloniality, the era of colonialism, settler colonialism. And so one of the challenges we face is exactly what you said, is when we think about the history of food in this country, we tend to overlook the roles and importance of indigenous food cultures, right? The fact that, you know, though they were the first farmers of this land, like they knew how to grow and sustain themselves. They had a sustainable many of them, to pick particularly if you're in the Midwest or the Plain States, had a sustainable supply of meat, bison, right, that was ultimately slaughtered because of racism and settler colonialism. The idea of slaughtering the bison, or buffalo as they were called at the time, was a way to control the indigenous tribes. Like, if they didn't have this, we knew they couldn't survive. And so now we have a system that's dependent upon a unsustainable kind of beef, cow, right, different kind of cattle, that we know is not sustainable in the same ways that bison herds were. And it moves all the way into, again, the enslavement of Africans, recognizing that Black people were, or Africans were brought here because of our agricultural capabilities, right? It wasn't just because of our physical capabilities, which were often told, or often the story, if it's told at all, is that, you know, people, Black people were hard workers, they were docile, they would listen. Perhaps, you know, the fact we can tolerate the heat better because of the melanin in our skin. But the simple fact of the matter is, the primary reason Black people were enslaved is because they knew how to grow the crops that were going to be grown in America, like the food that we actually could, that was being grown, whether it be rice in the Carolinas, or the animal husbandry techniques that we see taking place in Texas and Oklahoma. And so these are the kinds of, which makes sense from the perspective of the enslaver. You want to hire, you want to get labor that can grow the products that you're going to be cultivating. So it actually makes economic sense. It's just not the way we usually teach it. And so that's what I mean by decolonizing, is it's bringing to light a more fuller picture, right, on one hand, and then asking ourselves, based on this fuller picture, how might we reevaluate, or how might we have a deeper or better understanding of our food system and the changes that we might want to make or need to make, so that our system can be in alignment with the values that we think we uphold. And we have pretty clear values with respect to, like, American culture and American politics.
Well, you know, I love the way that you organized your book, and the first part of it, where you talk about knowing, thinking, being, and doing. So, you know, when you're knowing things and you're really dealing with what I learned from you is that, wow, this, just because we're, you know, we're over 150 years or more away from slavery, there's still trauma in people, in youth. You know, there's still so much about, you know, your self-image and self-love that we all need to take a look at, and especially if you are African American. And so when you get through knowing, thinking, and being, what's the doing that you think has to happen?
That's such an excellent observation. And I actually want to expand it a little bit to include, when we talk about trauma, like, we all are traumatized. like regardless of our racialization, like we are living in the vestiges of racial trauma because we've never had the kind of healing that one has to have to actually to heal from trauma. And by that I mean an actual account, right? A fair and honest account and assessment of what happened and a plan or something to move forward. Like in any relationship, right? You can have relationship difficulties and someone has to not just say, I'm sorry, but you have to work towards reconciliation. And because we haven't done that as a country, because we essentially after enslavement, we had roughly 8 years of an attempt at an interracial democracy. And then we had another 80 some odd years of forced segregation and a kind of the beginnings of a different kind of a version of racial, a racial caste that ultimately created, you know, allowed the trauma to linger or allowed racial trauma to linger. And so this impacts white people in terms of how they think about the land, who should be working the land, who shouldn't be working the land, right? How much people should get paid, the kinds of labor and certain skills and qualities people have, and also impacts non-white people, particularly Black people and Latinx folks, in terms of how we feel about ourselves and the desire to not have anything to do with the land or the traumas that we might bring with respect to agriculture and the things that we eat and how people perceive what it is we eat. And so when it gets to down to the doing, when I get down to the, you know, taking seriously our sources of knowledge and then analyzing what might we do in light of what we now have learned, how do we understand ourselves as human beings in light of all these things, right? So that's knowing, thinking, being. And then the doing is what I call praxis, right? And so really that's just taking on things we've learned and asking ourselves, okay, how might we change? What ways in which we're going to engage the world differently in light of what I have learned? And so that's really where I come up with those three different kinds of ways that are, you know, different practices, I call it in my book, about how we might eat differently. And so that's, you know, soulful eating, that's seeking justice for food workers and caring for the earth. So how might we take these kind of three broad ideas and apply them to ways in which we think about food in light of all the things that we've learned to get us to this new point?
You know, I couldn't help thinking of one of my heroes, Wendell Berry, who said eating's an agricultural act. And I think that what you're saying is eating is also a social justice act. And especially if you come from a deep history of enslavement, you know, around agriculture and food. And I am embarrassed to tell you this, but I feel like I should, because maybe some other people will relate to me. When I said, oh, the soul, you know, soul food. And I immediately thought of ribs and chicken. And then as I read your book, I was so embarrassed about that. Because that really isn't the soul food that you're talking about. So I'd love for you to talk about a little bit the soul and, you know, the whole idea of being vegan, looking at the way we eat food, is really part of that doing, that action, and this reinvention of who we are.
One of the things that was important for me to do in this project in terms of the beginnings, I would say the knowing, it was kind of learning about and you know, West African and early slave dietary practices. One of the both, I would say, best and worst parts of writing the book was that I spent a lot of time on plantations in Louisiana and Mississippi in agriculture, and did a lot of reading, learning about African food ways. And what was difficult about that is obviously, you know, you're reading through literature that's just dehumanizing, right? Literature that speaks about people, you know, my ancestors in ways that's dehumanizing, and that's extremely difficult. You know, because I think it just brings up all kinds of trauma. At the same time, it also is empowering, because what you're able to see, what you're able to really glean, I should say, from that is the kinds of knowledges that they brought with them, the kind of cooking that they brought with them, and the ways in which we ate that are beyond the kind of, I would say, static definitions of soul food that most people have. And that's essentially, you know, most people think when they think about soul food, they think about, you know, ribs, think about chicken, they think about, you know, chitlins, or maybe think about pecan pie, or they have different kinds of assumptions. And so what I talk about in the book, I guess two things. One is that soul food at its core really has been about the preservation and promotion of Black community. Soul food has been about, like, how might we actually allow feed ourselves in a way that allows us to sustain and allows us to grow. Soul as a concept really is trying to capture that essence, right? There's what I say is an affective, is a feeling when we talk about soul within Black culture. You know, you're talking about what it feels like to be in a space where, you know, people care about you, where there's solidarity among there, that where hope and faith really, I think, intermingle. And so soul food is the capturing an essence of all those kinds of categories. But what has constituted soul food has never been this like fixed, static, like this is what soul food is. It's always evolved because the foods that people had access to have shifted over time. The diet that we eat now is very different than the West African diet of our ancestors, such that what my argument is that this gives us permission, right, to not just have this fixed identity of what soul food is. And it gives us permission to recognize that soul food has and will continue to evolve. Now, given the negative impact of industrial agriculture, given the negative impact of factory farming, given all the negative impacts of our food system on Black people specifically, but people of color in general and poor people, I think the argument for an ethical veganism, basically what I call it, agent-specific and context-specific veganism, or in the book I call it Black veganism. And by this I mean, I first recognize that everybody can be vegan. Like, I grew up poor, and we wouldn't have been able to practice veganism, and so I understand that. However, we all can begin to eat in ways that raise our consciousness and awareness about the interconnectedness between racial oppression and food injustice and food apartheid. And so that, in a sense, is beginning the kind of awareness, right? Connecting the dots between racial injustice and food justice, right? And so that's a part of that practice. At the same time, I'm arguing that as best as you can, you need to opt out of this system of animal agriculture, especially because of the racialization and animalization of the Black body, right? The ways in which Black folks are seen as animals, and how and by consuming that product, we really are allowing ourselves to be complicit, I think, in a structure that is really premised on a racial caste. Like, the development of the ideas around race are intimately tied with the animal. And we can't just say, well, I'm a human, and I'm a human too. And so that way, you know, to equate ourselves with the oppressor is not the goal, right? The goal is to redefine what it means to be human, right? To opt out of this system, to both unlearn this way of being human that's clearly about extraction, exploitation, and to redefine a new way of being human that's about love, that's about compassion, that's about justice.
You're listening to Sprouts Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program bringing you local radio productions of national interest. Today you're listening to an interview about the spirit of soul food produced by Heartland Stories Radio, a weekly radio show exploring food farming and public health. We return now to our interview with Dr. Christopher Carter.
I'm here today with Reverend Dr. Christopher Carter, who is the Assistant Professor of Theology and Religious Studies at the University of San Diego and has written a most fascinating book called The Spirit of Soul Food, Race, Faith, and Food Justice. So Dr. Carter, as we look at trying to break down these stereotypes, I really appreciated that you actually have looked at a lot of different ways of what's happening and what has happened, and you actually have talked a lot about the structural, well, I heard first a structural evil, but it's structural racism. And you do look at that in the book as well. And I wondered if you would talk a little bit about that structural racism that we're up against, it seems, quite a bit.
Yeah, I use structural evil and structural racism to a certain degree, almost interchangeably. I mean, but my argument is that our food system is structurally racist, that it's the foundations of our food system, you know, are racist because it starts with the, you know, beginnings of it is the genocide of indigenous folks and the enslavement of Black labor. And when you look at the outcomes, right, often people want to think about racism, we think of it as people's intent, an intentional act, right, someone saying a word that we find offensive. But a more helpful definition of racism, I think, a definition of racism that allows us to understand the impact, right, of these racial inequalities is to look at the actual outcomes, right? So racism isn't just someone's intentions. I would say that their intentions are important, but what's more important is the outcome or the impact of those decisions. And the outcome or impact of food in America with respect to the distribution of food is that people of color, particularly Black people, are more likely to suffer from food injustice or food apartheid, right? They're more likely to suffer from these systems that are put in place that have denied Black people access. And this isn't because Black people are lazy or Black people are dumb or Black people don't, you know how to work or know how to grow food. This is because of the systems that have been in place, such as redlining, that have limited where Black people can live, such as the different kind of restrictive covenants that grocery stores have, that have limited way where they can be, and to limit access for Black folks to be able to access this food and poor people to access food. The ways in which, you know, bus lines, different kind of public transportation may not be accessible to certain spaces. All these things are done intentionally, which is part of the reason why we use the term, or I use the term food apartheid, because a desert is a naturally occurring phenomenon. The things I'm talking about, these are done intentionally. These are done in a structural way. And so structural racism is a way to help make explicit the ways in which our system of food distribution, right, or anything that we might say is racist, how the system functions, right, in a way that disproportionately harms people of color, where the inequities can be traced along racial lines. I call this system evil. I mean, that's the language. I make a moral claim on it. This is evil. I think it's inconsistent not only with any kind of any religious tradition, I would say, but with the vision and values that we claim to uphold as Americans.
Well, I could agree with you on that. There certainly is a lot of shame that we should have that we don't seem to be facing. And also to start looking at what we have going on now. Like, for example, some of the southern states and their moves to control the voting laws are actually kind of more of the same. Structural racism. So it's not stopping, and so actually we're responsible for a lot of things now, it seems to me.
I think we are kidding ourselves if we believe that we have moved to a place that is post-racial. I think, you know, the presidential elections, honestly, the election of Barack Obama ushered in an era of a kind of explicit racial politic that we hadn't seen since the Civil Rights Movement in America. And, you know, we have candidates that are elected now running for office that clearly align with a kind of white nationalist policy. People should find troubling. You know, like, that's what it is. And you know, it's, I will tell you that my grandfather, you know, did not believe he would live to see this happen again, in his words. And, you know, when someone that's almost 90 years old is speaking like this, you know, you pay attention because he's seen this movie before. And so that's, you know, that's concerning. That is legitimately concerning.
I really liked very much reading your stories about your grandfather, and I'm happy to hear that he's still out there.
Yeah, no, my grandpa is alive and well, and my grandpa, as I talk about in the book, was a migrant picker, had a garden that I grew up, you know, helping with in the summers, and that was more like a homestead, basically. His fingerprints are throughout the entire text. You know, he's only got roughly a third grade education formally, but he has a kind of ability to really to see truth in things that you have. You know, growing up in Jim Crow South will give you that ability to see through lies in a way that I think you know, you have to have been there to understand. And I'm definitely grateful for the things he taught me and the patience he's had with me, because, you know, I've not always been the easiest grandson to have, to be fair to him.
Well, I'm so glad that you were there and you captured his stories. I think that's so important that we must not forget. We have to keep these stories. I wanted to ask you about Farm Forward before we close our interview. Farm Forward is something that I know it's about, you know, the confinement feedlot operations, the CAFOs. You know, you were very clear about how you saw that treatment of animals is super important, and so it made you a vegan. Do you want to say something about both Farm Forward and your, I think, journey becoming a vegan?
Yeah. When I started writing this book, I was basically trying to figure out a way to eat that was in alignment with my values. That's how the CliffsNotes version. As I began to be more exposed to the structural evil that is within our food system, you know, as a person of faith, I was like, I need to change how I'm eating. And I did not want to become vegan. It's not like I was like, ooh, this would be great and super easy. It was not. But it, for me, felt like it was the right thing to do. It was a moral thing to do. And I could do it. And I was a vegetarian for a long time and worked my way towards the veganism I practice today. My veganism really is about people. It's really veganism. I always say I'm vegan for the people. It's the people who are impacted by industrial animal agriculture that moved me to opt out of that system because of the harm that it has on our planet and on those people. And to that end, this is where my work with Farm Forward has been really helpful and instrumental. I spoke earlier about plantations I was able to visit, and I wouldn't have been able to do that if it had not been for not only their funding, but the relationships they have with different organizations and corporations in the South. And just the advocacy work they've been able to do, I think right now, you know, we're really focusing on humane washing, the ways in which people try to frame different products as humanely raised, but they're just using different kinds of terms and labels that are really generic, that don't have meaning or are enforceable. And so they've been really at the forefront of that work. And I'm really excited to be a part of their team and supporting them. And they've allowed me to kind of also figure out how I can have these kinds of conversations about factory farming in religious spaces. And that's not always easy because you have a lot of resistance, particularly among more conservative religious people. And I've been navigating that space surprisingly well, actually. And so yeah, that's the work they do. And I'm really grateful for the opportunity they've given me to not only do my research, but also to talk about the work that I'm able to do.
Well, it's clear you are on the right path because we are all going to have to stop eating as much meat as we do. We have no choice. If we look at greenhouse gases, that's a third coming from agriculture and most of it from the kinds of corn and soybeans and the way that we raise cattle and other meat and chickens and so on. It's not good for the earth, and everyone kind of knows that. You know, I have a couple questions that are important to me and I want to ask, and I think we have a lot to learn from those who were descendants of enslaved people, and I wanted to see what you thought about that. What should we be learning from this?
I think one of the primary takeaways, well, I see two things. And one, the first one is just the importance of, I think, hope, right? Of really cultivating a sense of hope. I can't imagine how difficult it must have been to go to be born in a particular kind of capacity, knowing that you never really could exercise any kind of individual autonomy or freedom. And yet what we find through music and through religion and studying enslaved Africans was many of them and their communities were able to have a sense of hope that things were going to get better. And it's that hope that allowed them to continue to flourish or, you know, to survive in a way that gave them a sense of dignity, because they definitely weren't flourishing. And that to me is powerful. You know, it really to me speaks to the not only the power of hope, but it makes me recognize that some things that we may feel are hopeless, really there is hope underneath that hopelessness if we are willing to look towards it. And so the first thing I would say we should learn from them is hope. And the second I would say is this is kind of an expression that you find in a lot of Black religious spaces is the term is like to make a way out of no way. And that I think speaks to the way the gifts of improvisation, this move towards justice and love that you find that I would say you really glean from enslaved Africans. That, you know, you had to find a way to make a way out of no way, something that seemed improbable. You had to try to accomplish it. And so I'm thinking about these two principles, you know, hope and making a way out of no way. And I'm thinking about them relative to climate change, especially right now, because we are really at a tipping point and we have to figure out a way to change, as you noted, how we are eating and what we are doing with respect to transportation and other important sectors if we are going to survive as a species. And I have hope. It's hard to have hope sometimes, but I have hope that we will be able to figure out a way forward that will allow us to be able to survive and allow my son to be able to survive, you know, and hopefully for him to have a family if that's something he so chooses.
That was so well said, and it's been a real pleasure, Dr. Carter, to be talking with you today. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
That's it for Sprouts. You've been listening to an interview with Dr. Christopher Carter. Sprouts theme music is Torpedoes on Tuesday by Poison Control Center. Sprouts is a weekly program produced in collaboration with community radio stations and independent producers across the country, bringing you local radio productions of national interest. The program is coordinated and distributed by Pacifica Radio. Thanks to Brian David at Satellite Operations. If you or someone at your station has a radio production that you wish to rebroadcast on Sprouts to showcase it nationally, contact our air traffic controller, Ursula Rudenberg, at ursula@pacifica.org. This week's producer was yours truly, Charlie Knorr. Thank you for listening and see you next week on Sprouts.
Listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM and streaming on the web, kboo.fm. I'm Don Jacobson, and moving on, we'll be here in just a few minutes right after the news.